Welcome once again, everyone, to Food Conversations Season 5. And before we begin, I'll say what I have said at every show, and that is that we once again acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwemek people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for all of us. Now, today I'm delighted to have in the studio Jamie Smith, a young man who was born and raised in Salmon Arm, but who has traveled far to learn the craft of winemaking and other assorted skills, and has now come back to his home base to start up Marionette Winery with his partner Amanda Eastwood, creating handcrafted small vat batches of wine from five different varietals for the delectation of wine aficionados throughout BC. Welcome, Jamie, to Food Conversations.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I hope you recognized yourself in that introduction.
I did. Very well.
The territory.
Perfect.
Well, let's start with a name. What's in a name? Well, a name is often an interesting thing, and it has a little bit of a story. In this case, Marionette Wineries is not what you think. You don't think of marionettes when you look at the south, the east-facing slope that the winery is built on. Where's that come from?
So, yeah, when we were building the winery, we were at that stage where we were looking for the concept, you know, and we had some ideas. And a local lady came walking down the driveway, and she was interested in what we were doing. I think she'd heard that we were building a winery, but she just told us this great story about growing up a couple streets away and going to a birthday party there when she was in grade two. And it was a sort of birthday party where the whole class is invited. And the family that was living where Marionette is now, she remembered that there was like they had this hand-painted sort of wooden caravan, and they had hundreds of like marionettes that they'd made. And that it just sort of blew her mind, her young mind, all of the shows that they put on for the kids. It was something really special, something like beyond even like the, I don't know what kids did, I mean, maybe like McDonald's birthday parties or whatever the typical birthday party was. And she remembered it like her whole life. Like she was my age. She was like in her 40s. And she just remembered like that the child whose birthday party that was, their family, they left that year. And she remembered his name. And we looked up, like, we were so sort of, like, enamored with that story. And
it's kind of intriguing, isn't it?
Yeah, and it seemed like a doorway into, at a moment when we were looking for a concept, a doorway into a world of imagination, you know. And we took it, you know. Mm. And it led us to this family called the Kirbys, who I think went on to start a theater company called Caravan Stage Company.
Well, you know, I was totally intrigued by your story when we talked about it just the other day. And I looked up the background. You'd suggested I do this. Well, I actually did it. I followed your advice.
Right.
And it turns out that the Marionette... The marionettes, the puppets that this young girl saw, were part of the entourage of the Caravan Stage Company. And the Caravan Stage Company, of course, I immediately thought of the Caravan Farm Theater down near Armstrong. It's not the same at all. It's completely different. Both Canadian, interestingly. Mm-hmm. But the Caravan Stage Company toured all over North America, and this was one of the many stops it made, with six wagons, beautifully painted, and Clydesdale horses pulling them. And one of the reasons they stopped was probably it's getting a little hard to get your Clydesdales out in the Trans-Canada Highway without problems. And the imagination, the stimulus to imagination was very central to what they did. They eventually became seaborne. They built a boat, a 100-foot-long floating theater sailboat, if you can imagine it, in Kingston, Ontario. It was completed in 1997, and they toured Europe, can you imagine it, on canals. There's lots of canals in Europe where you can connect, right? They toured Europe from 2005 to 2013, then they came back to North America, toured all over North America on the boat, on the boat, so they had to go coastlines and rivers and stuff like that. And then now they're based in Victoria since 2020.
Really? They're here.
So
okay,
they're still alive. And the, I'm happy to say the Caravan Farm Theater is also still alive.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You touched into a little sort of historical nexus that most people wouldn't.
Well, yeah. And I, you know, like I think for me, it was the thing that for me was really important about that story was that I was aware growing up here, obviously, that there is a strong vein of that world of, you know, there's a strong community of people that live in a world of imagination in a really productive, creative way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have evidence of that with things like the Caravan Farm Theater, Runaway Moon Theater. We have the Salmar Film Society, which is, you know, very unique, I feel, in terms of showing art house cinema, art house films in a community of this size. And the arts center, the live music scene that's been here, you know what I mean, since then.
Absolutely.
All of these things, to be able to tie into that was sort of a wish come true that I hadn't really even thought would be possible, you know what I mean?
Imagination and creativity, it's an important part of your inner world.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a world of imagination, much to the chagrin of my teachers. I was that kid who never understood the assignment, you know.
Or because, reinterpreted it.
Yeah, I had my grade 8 math teacher came to the winery a few years after we started. I'll never forget. He, you know, it was lovely, like, seeing him again. And then he said to me as he was leaving, he was like, "Hey, I hope you don't mind me asking, but how did you, like, you were like," he was like, "how did you end up doing this? Because like you were just like off in a dream world. You're like the whole time you were in school."
He couldn't understand that winemaking was not part of your career plan, but that didn't mean you couldn't do it.
And I just had to say, well, I don't know, man. It just, you know, being in a world of imagination doesn't mean you're not there. You know what I mean?
You mentioned that you'd been reading The Hobbit to your kids.
Yeah.
And that had sort of sparked your sense of metaphor and your sense of imagery and fantasy stories that nevertheless relate to us in terms of the reality of our own lives. And that this was kind of a recreation of and a reconnection to some of your sort of imaginative meanderings.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was struck by the beginning of The Hobbit with Bilbo Baggins and Gandalf, and obviously I haven't read The Hobbit since for a lot of years. I think last time I read it was probably when I was in my teens. But
how many times have you read it, do you think?
Well, I think like a lot of people, it's sort of one of these things that like a lot of people who love the books, you know, return to the, like, it is one of the rare sort of massive series that you can read, put back on your shelf, and know that you're going to be in there again.
Lord
at some
of the
point.
Rings like, just goes on.
Yeah. And I mean, like, yeah, I guess this time through, in just starting out, I was really struck by the genius of Bilbo Baggins versus Gandalf, because I'm not sure if everybody remembers, but the way it starts, like the opening chapter, is basically describing how Bilbo Baggins is like the least likely adventurer. And yet, it's in him to be that. And Gandalf shows up and is like really amused and sort of bemused by how, how Bilbo doesn't seem like he understands that. You know, like Bilbo understands how comfortable and safe he is, and how much he loves his hobbit hole, and how much he loves to sit on the bench outside of his hobbit hole and just be comfortable living as a hobbit and not having adventures. But Gandalf comes and basically says, "Bilbo Baggins, whether you like it or not, you're about to go on an adventure which you'll never come back from, not completely. You know, you'll be put in danger. You'll be exposed to like the most dangerous, most powerful magic in the universe." You know what I mean? And all of that is sort of like in Bilbo from the beginning. And I feel like that sort of, I felt like I really identified with both of those characters. I feel like they're both part of my consciousness. You know what I mean? Like I have a strong Bilbo Baggins character in me, and I have Gandalf. Like it's always prodding me to go off and go on adventures when I don't feel like I really want to. You know what I mean? Yet I do.
If you just tuned into the show, you may not realize that I'm talking to eminent winemaker Jamie Smith of Marionette Winery, because we've branched into what I think is very typical of guests on this show, the fact that our lives are not straight lines and we travel in circuitous ways to get to where we are. And that is part of the, if you like, the magic of human existence, that we don't start in one place and go straight line towards something else. We we go here, we go there, and we enjoy every minute of it. So let's take this imaginative child who reads and enjoys things. This is you, not your children this time. After you finished school here, you drifted off and did some of the things that are perhaps more mainstream. You went to Calgary and started to study English literature.
Yeah.
And you were in a band?
Yes. Yeah, that was
okay.
My dream. Yeah.
The proverbial post-adolescent, pre-adolescent band. What was your band called and how brilliant was it?
I mean, at the time, we thought we had something really unique. We were called Mercer, not after Rick Mercer, but from a character in a science fiction novel, or like a concept in Philip Dick's novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Mercer.
I'm sure most of our listeners were thinking.
It was a super obscure, super nerdy like reference, which obviously lent to us, like, that's probably a good reason why we never made it.
What kind of music did you do? Loud?
It was a little bit complex for the time, because it was like 90s rock was really in vogue, and we did this sort of like slightly jazz chordy, but slightly, it was really strongly influenced by like Radiohead and stuff like that. We just weren't in the right time and place, and the band sort of drifted apart. People were moving, like the drummer was moving back to Vancouver.
And you drifted away across the ocean.
Yeah, and I went back to university for a semester. I picked up some linguistics courses, and I was thinking of doing an MA. And then I remember walking out of an MA class, like a prep class, sort of for literature, and I just, like, everybody else in the room had this reading repertoire, which was like 100 times what mine was, right? Like, they were just talking about like stuff that I just knew. I'm like, no, man, I just don't belong here. And I walked out a little bit depressed, not depressed, but sort of downhearted.
At loose ends, for
yeah.
sure.
And I saw this poster for it, you know, a native speaker of Spanish doing like classes in Spanish. And it just came to me like in a flash. I was like, I'm going to go live in Spain. Of course.
Of course.
And
that's
so
the obvious
that's what
thing
I did,
to do.
Yeah. That's the sort of decision it was. I worked for the rest of the semester to save up money and then bought a ticket. Yeah. And
did you fly or take a boat?
I flew. So I wasn't like the expats that were my idols. I wasn't like Hemingway or all those.
A previous era.
Yeah,
exactly.
It was trying to live a modern version of that.
So if we're talking about momentary experiences, what was it like stepping off the plane or landings in Spain and looking around and saying, what am I doing here?
Yeah, it was a huge shock. I don't remember a lot about it, actually, but because I feel like, it's one of these things where I feel like that was a different person. And the only thing that connects me to that person is my narrative memory. You know what I mean? Like, but it was what I do remember is just the shock of how, being surrounded, obviously, by a language that I didn't have really any words in, and the culture that was, a city that was so like. One thing I really remember is, the city that I was in was so beautiful that it literally, like, I almost couldn't sounds like which hyperbolic, but like Salamanca, okay, sure. Yeah, Golden City. And yeah, I remember walking into the Plaza Mayor, which is like the main square, and just like, honestly, I almost couldn't comprehend it. Like, I had to like, yeah, like I had to just, I was just like struck by it. And
there was a sense of magic.
This is, yes, and absolutely, you, yeah.
And magic of some relevance when it came to wine as well. And you're growing, you know, wine is very much part of the culture of Spain. A lot of it is grown there. It's a lot of varietals. And you started to, well, you were also teaching English as a second language. What was the process of evolution that brought wine more than just a beverage that you drink with your meal into something more meaningful?
So I've got a good story. This isn't my story, actually. This is Amanda's story. Amanda Eastwood's my partner, my business partner. And she's got a great story about this, which sort of illustrates what it was like for me. And obviously she's not here, but I'm gonna try to do her story justice. So she had a similar entrance into Spain that I did. Different city, but sort of the same sort of experience. And she was with she came down with a friend from England, which is where she's from. And they started living in Malaga, where they were. And she bought, like, they were sort of amazed at how cheap wine was. That's the first sort of entrance point for me too into wine. It was like, wow, wine is like honestly,
it's like water.
You could buy a Tetra pack of wine for like 50 cents, a liter of wine for like 50 cents. And, or even less than that, actually, because I think they weren't on the euro at that point. So it was like even cheaper than that. But so we like, Amanda's got this great story where her and a friend bought this like ultra cheap Tetra pack of wine and went down to the local square where people were doing this thing called botellón. Young people would buy their sort of alcohol and mix and ice and stuff and gather in groups and then just drink in the main square. And you'd think that was like a horrendous like social crisis, but it was actually super civilized. And it was just, it's just evidence of how alcohol can be
embedded in a culture.
Yeah. And it was really responsible for the most part of, you know, how it was like consumed. And so they're sitting there on a bench and they've got like their Tetra pack, and somebody came up who was like had way too much alcohol. Okay. After I've just said it can be, you know, it's evidence of how it can be consumed responsibly. In this particular story, somebody that was like had way too much to drink came over and said, "Hey, can I have some of your wine? Or what are you guys drinking?" And that's sort of an element of botellón too, is that you're sort of like, you're mixing with everybody else. And Amanda and her friend were like, "Ah, yeah, absolutely, you know." And they took out their Tetra pack, and the guy literally was like, "Oh, no, no, thank you." And then, and left in sort of like in
dismay.
In quite a hurry. And they were like left holding this Tetra pack looking at like, what? Like, you know, it's all right. And it, you know, like it, the revelation that sort of you can, yes, you can buy the cheapest wine there, but if you go up like $1 in value, you have a wine that is just absolutely amazing. You go up another euro and you have a wine that literally wouldn't be able to get it here in the BC liquor store. You know what I mean? You go up to like 5 euros and you have wines that are on another tier, like that, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is that wine is just part of the culture to the point where everybody enjoys it. It's not elitist. It's like if you go to Champagne, like I remember going to Champagne and being in a bar watching, this is a while ago, but Canada was in the like the Winter Olympics, and it was like a really good, they were really winning.
Which was, isn't always the case.
No, yeah, this was like, I think this is 2010 or something like that. And Yeah, I was in this bar in Champagne, and everybody's drinking champagne. Like, people watching the hockey are drinking champagne. And the champagne that they're drinking, like what I'm saying is, it was, for them, it was sort of like drinking lager. It was just like drinking, like, you just go to the, that's just what you drink. Like, if you live in Champagne, it doesn't matter who you are, you go out and you drink champagne. You know what I mean? And there's champagne for everybody. Like, there's champagne you only get in Champagne. And Champagne's got this brilliant, like, marketing where they export it with this branding of, like, a luxury product. But that's only for us to see. Like, what it actually is the wine of the region, and it's the wine of the people that live in that region. That's what wine is, and that I had no idea existed. You know what I mean?
So people, the wine becomes embedded in the culture, and the culture reflects the wine that
yes.
people are drinking. So on a given day, you might drink what probably in Spain would be considered basic plonk.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could walk down the street and you could drink something that was, anybody who knew wine would say, where'd you get that? That's amazing. That's wonderful stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's like, to me, I think, like Amanda and I used to talk about this quite a bit, but it's like, you know, in ancient Greek culture, they had this idea of civitas, which is like the ancient Greek cities were built on it. So they when they, like the Romans sort of took this on from them, but it was like, if you lived in Athens, for example, you had this sense that, yeah, you lived in this, like, I don't know, like a house or apartment, you know, I don't know what the Greeks, ancient Greeks had, but let's say houses, small houses. But mm-hmm. that wasn't, like, it wasn't your castle as we have it. Like, the city was where you lived. Like, everything yeah. you did was in the city, the parks, the taverns, the entertainment complexes, the, you identified, like, the city was you and you were the city. And that was really the underlying philosophy of building a city in ancient Greece. And that is totally the opposite of our idea of what a city is. And I think that in Europe, that they, like, obviously modern Europe is very different, and it sort of squats above, you know what I mean, like, and around the traditional, like, city centers of Europe. Mm-hmm. But it's still there. Like, there is still that idea that if you're from Cádiz, if you're from Seville, if you're from Madrid, maybe not Madrid, because Madrid is like London. It's like it absorbs everybody else. Yeah. But there is this idea that you are the city and the city is you. And the wine is part of that. The wine really, like in any region that produces wine, is part of the civitas. It is basically part of you and you are part of it. You know, you drink it, but it is you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean. No, what I'm struck by is the richness of the way you relate to wine.
Yep.
It's not just a beverage, a liquid that, you know, you make out of squeezing grapes together. It's it's something that represents and resonates with a lot of cultural patterns and behaviors and identities. Well, obviously, if you and Amanda are having this kind of relationship with wine, you're not going to sit around and just consume it. And you didn't. You actually, at a certain point, said, let's learn more. If there's magic to it, there's got to be some practical sides to it. And you went to a university in Brighton,
mm-hmm.
where quite a well-known course, a bachelor's degree in science, the science of viticulture and oenology, mm-hmm. which is the growing of grapes and the science of wine, to translate from the Latin and the Greek. Why was it Brighton? Brighton is where people go to be down by the sea.
Yeah. Well, again, I have to give credit to Amanda for this. We were both at the end of, like, teaching English, sort of wanted a change. And then we were looking at different ideas. We were going to do something together, you know, at that point in our time together. And we, yeah, so I remember that it was like she was from Brighton, originally from London.
Oh, okay.
And she found the course, and it just seemed to be like, it was one of those like eureka moments where you're just like, I mean, for me, like, I was like, oh, that is absolutely the best idea to, you know what I mean? It just fit. Like, it was like the story of Marionette, you know, this, like the story of the name of Marionette. It
came flying out of the ether.
It was like
and
a
it
talisman.
Landed on you.
Yeah. Like, I do think, you know, like, as we create our own story going through life, we have these talismanic moments, you know what I mean? That you're like, yeah, I was waiting around for that to happen. That was the story, the plot point, you know what I mean, that needed to happen to move me further.
Just going to remind listeners that I'm talking today with Jamie Smith, who's the co-owner of Marionette Wineries here in Salmon Arm. And Jamie's describing this wonderful trajectory, which is a combination of imagination and practicality, mm-hmm. which is always an interesting combination, led you to a university in Brighton. And was this university one that had some kind of reputation with respect to what you learned about wine and its culture and growing and the practical side?
Oh, I'll be honest with you. It was just, it was one of those decisions where I just thought it made sense because it was a program in English. You know what I mean? It wasn't like I had to go...
learn a lot of obscure terminology in
another
language.
Yeah, like studying enology and viticulture, a science degree when I was a lit major, was daunting anyway. And so the opportunity to do it in English in the UK for me was really exciting. And the fact at that point it was sort of before Brexit, so UK was part of the European Union. So like a lot of the people that we studied with, the plan, obviously, I mean, the UK has a really good, really growing sparkling wine industry, like champagne-based or champagne-modeled.
Using the kind of old technology
that's
used to make
the traditional method, yeah. So they have a great industry. It's not huge, though. It's smaller than the BC wine industry. So there's limited placement coming out of a degree program. So what a lot of people wanted to do was go down to Europe. You know what I mean? Like because
you had a lot of Europeans actually in the faculty.
Yes.
And
yeah, we had a great professor. That's the other thing actually that was really interesting about the program was, if you studied in University of Bordeaux, you would get the Bordeaux academic like approach to winemaking. If you studied in Germany in Geisenheim, you would get the German like Geisenheim model of like winemaking. If you studied in the University of Adelaide, you'd get a university focused or industry focused, you know, degree that was looking at putting you in some place like Wolf Blass making like 10 million liters of wine of Shiraz a year or something. So like every wine industry, every education that you have in the wine industry reflects the industry where you are getting educated. Mm-hmm. Brighton was different because it was like this mashup of like different people from different places actually teaching it. Like we had the wine studies head like of enology was from Australia. So there you had like this
industrial
guy.
Industrial model.
Yeah, totally. And like no like magic, no imagination, just...
this is a business.
This is what you do to make wine, and there's nothing artistic or creative about it. It's just you do this.
He wouldn't have read The Hobbit.
No,
times.
He would find a lot of what I've said today a little bit ridiculous. But yeah.
So here you are at university. It's a university program that I suspect is not reflected to a great extent on this continent. I suspect most people who want to learn about wine would go to a school in Europe, at least that's probably where they'd find lots of them, and each country with its own mm-hmm. version. But after you had completed this course, you also went off and learned about the WSET. That's a special set of qualifications. Do you want to describe what that is?
Yeah, and I, like, when we were studying, we were aware of the fact that there's winemaking and there's grape growing and then there's wine business. And there's not a lot of people have to do both, you know, or all three. But I think we sort of realized that, especially having a very sort of no-nonsense, just the facts sort of wine enology sort of head of studies, that for us...
That's an Aussie.
Yeah. For us, it was like, to keep the magic sort of alive, we sort of realized, me and Amanda, I'm talking about when I say we, we realized that a lot of the magic was actually in the selling of wine, you know what I mean? The sort of... a lot of the elitism as well, too, is not
fairly widespread in the wine world,
but that is changing. Like you know, people are more and more interested in the artisan winery, whatever region it's in. You know what I mean? People are more interested in it if you go to a wine region, if you go to Tuscany, if you go to like the Chianti region, or if you go to Chablis in France. The real charm is not going to the
factories.
Yeah, it's not going to, like, if you go to Bordeaux, it's not, the interesting thing is not going to the chateaus that, like, Napoleon said were the best ones in, like, whatever, 1811. Like, as beautiful as they are, as much of a sort of speculated stock as they are, those wines, it's frankly uninteresting to people who want to have an experience of wine. Hmm. What's really interesting is that little winery that you find that's down this little, you know...
back road somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. And has some name that's tied to the village, some ancient legend or something. And, you know, you have to wait at the door of the tasting room, which is also a storage room. And the winemaker or grape grower finally shows up and gives you a tasting and a story and an amazing experience. And you just feel like you've connected with something that's beyond a product.
And he's not dressed up in a suit and tie.
Yeah, he's not selling you wine. He's just showing you what happens.
A question that pops up in my mind now, and it has in the past, is the whole notion of, when you taste wine, developing a vocabulary that describes all of the subtle elements in the taste, the flavor, the smell. I use words that I barely know what I'm talking about. Nose and things like
right,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there a certain amount of selling that goes on in that sort of world? Sometimes people say, with a tiny hint of molasses and
right, yeah,
and skunk and
fireworks. That's a great one. That's my favorite one. Yeah, I think that's a very misunderstood aspect of wine tasting. I think that what people don't understand is what's happening there is that when you're taught how to taste wine at that level of the WSET and, you know, beyond.
What does that stand for, WSET?
Well, it used to be Wine, Spirits, and Education Trust. And then Amanda's actually gone much farther in it than me. She's working on, she's sort of like got one exam away from the diploma.
A postgraduate degree.
Yeah, that. It is like, it's an insane amount of studying. But she was saying that when she was doing it, a few years ago now, that they were dropping the spirits. So it's going to be WET, wet, I think, but which is a weird acronym. But yeah, it used to be spirits too. So, I mean, that was quite an interesting aspect of it. But I think it's a UK-based, like, spirits and wine, like, like selling. Like, I think the background of that is that London, more than... Like, London, I think... Sorry, I'm just going off on a slight tangent here, but London basically and the UK historical sort of wine market as a buying market built Bordeaux and built Burgundy, built the port industry, it built the sherry industry.
Because they bought so much of it.
And it was related to the British Empire, you know what I mean? Like
all those little pink countries on the map.
Totally. And it's not like, I mean, the British Empire is obviously responsible. Like it's nefarious, obviously, in the things that it did. We know that about what's happened here in Canada. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying it's a good or bad thing. Like it's ambiguous
just a phenomenon
thing. Yeah. And you know, a lot of people like who grow grapes and make wine in Montpellier in the south of France would argue that don't look at that kindly, because they were the wine industry at the time of the Romans and all through French history. It was the southern, like Languedoc region.
Yes.
that sort of made the wine for France. And the British chose Burgundy, the Loire Valley, and Bordeaux because they were on navigable rivers or they were seaport and they could easily import, especially as well. If you look at like the sherry industry and the port industry, most of those great houses like Osborne, Harvey's, they're all English names. Why are they English names? Because when the British defeated Wellington, they basically built those houses. You know what I mean? They took a wine style that was regional, made it into a massive industry, and then exported it to themselves.
For sure.
You know what I mean? Where was I? What were we talking about?
We're talking about the wine tasting world.
So WSET sort of comes out of that, comes out of like that, the fact that London is still probably the biggest exchange market for wine. You know what I mean? Like a massive, massive industry. New York is obviously also huge in terms of like the rise of America, you know, the American Empire. But London still stands as a massive, massive market.
So is the tasting, the nuances, the language, the mystique, sometimes the possibly even flim-flam associated with naming and describing wine varietals and their flavors, their nuances, is that an outgrowth of this massive market where everything sort of came together?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's basically a way of learning how to describe what you're experiencing. Like, going back to what I was saying, that's a very misunderstood aspect of wine tasting. People hear somebody saying that, like a sommelier, and they're immediately intimidated by it. And I feel like it's sad that that's what happens, because you're watching somebody who's very highly trained being like able to say, I'm tasting this fruit, I'm tasting this thing, like molasses or fireworks, whatever, gunpowder, that isn't present. Like, I don't see it here, but that aroma I'm detecting, that actual flavor, that flavor has been created in the wine and I'm detecting it. And that's the most amazing thing about wine. When yeast ferment, they do create flavor compounds that did not exist in the grape juice. They can create yes, hundreds of them. And every single human organoleptic apparatus, i.e. the mechanisms in our body that detect these very... Like, we have an amazing system that can detect infinitesimal sort of amounts of aroma compounds.
Indeed.
But everybody's different. Like, so we can, like, some person could detect raspberry, like, aromas much better than the next person. So sommeliers are trained how to access that part of their brain through practice and experience. And your average person isn't. I mean, so... But anybody can learn that. It's just that when you did it, if you were trained and you practiced at it, you would start saying that, but it would be different than Mr. or Mrs. or Ms. Sommelier. You know what I mean? it'd be very different. Like, you'd have a different thing. Well, I don't taste that, but I do taste this. You know what I mean? Like,
so it's quite individualized in a sense.
Yeah, it's super individualized. It's completely subjective.
Remind listeners now that I'm speaking with Jamie Smith, who's the co-owner of a wonderful winemaking operation on the east-facing slope of the east side of Salmon Arm called Marionette Winery. I think our listeners can tell that wine lore, wine, the world of wine is more than just a sort of a business. It's some of the magic that we were talking about earlier, some of the imaginative elements are sort of blended in to the wine and the winemaking process. Now, you did travel and work in Portugal, I understand, and in Germany.
Portugal, France, and England.
France and England.
Yeah, we were. And
And from them, from this wide range of varietals that you came in contact with, you developed a sort of a sense of what wine was good for this and good for that. But you came back to Canada. What was it that made you say, it's time to go back, well, to you, to your home, and Amanda coming to the colony of British, of Canada, British North America?
So the underlying motive for that was that it was right in the middle of the, or right at the, yeah, I guess the middle of the economic crisis of 2010, 2011, when Portugal and Spain and Greece, well, a lot of the wine-producing countries were really hard hit, and there just wasn't opportunity. We put out like hundreds of resumes, and the one that came back that seemed like, again, that sort of like, this is the one, you know what I mean, was for a winery called Gary Oaks in Salt Spring Island. So that just seemed, I'd never actually, I grew up in San Marino, but I'd actually never been to Salt Spring Island. So for me, that was like a, I, at the time, to be honest with you, wanted to stay, I was really keen to live in Évora, where I made wine in Portugal. I love that city. I love the region of Alentejo. It's just so interesting and beautiful.
Do you go back and visit sometimes?
I've never been back, actually.
It's a one-way.
Yeah, I mean, one day I'd like to, but it just, yeah, things after that with having kids and then starting a winery, it just never.
That can be a bit of a preoccupation.
But
what made you decide that you'd come full circle and come back to a land and a property that was very much part of your earliest years?
Yeah, so well, we were living and working in Salt Spring Island, and we came up for Christmas, and the, like, we were sitting around my family's kitchen table, and we were all just, we all got excited talking about the prospect of, wouldn't it be nice to have a really, really small winery here in Salmon Arm? And at the time, so this is like 2012, the real estate hadn't, like, it was much lower than it is now in terms of prices. So it was possible, like, this property that Marionette was on, it had sat derelict for a good 10 years. And the price had sort of come down to a point where, like, I think my dad was saying when we were there, he's like, well, there is this property right on this road on, and this is a good, like, this was the fruit growing bench, you know? And we were like, really, let's go have a look at it. So we walked down the driveway, which is now where Marionette was. And there was this lovely sort of farmhouse that had been turned into a faux Spanish like house, oh, like in the 70s, you know, like the faux 70s Spanish, like stucco and plywood archways and stuff.
Did something go off in your mind?
Yeah, it was like, for Amanda and I at the point, like, sadly, we couldn't save, like, we did actually, we went quite a ways down the road of trying to save the house, but it had, the additions that had been made had sort of destroyed the foundation and filled, like, there were some massive mistakes that had been made. Yeah.
You know, Jamie, it's almost like that Spanish style house built on a hillside in Salmon Arm, far away from Spain, was a little nod from fate to say, oh, you have a connection here. So you bought the land.
Yeah, which was, it was a bit of a stretch, but it was a good price. And
good land to grow wine.
Yeah, and it was, we were really struck by, like, how the hill goes down. Like, it is, it's south-facing on the, like, when you drive down the driveway, the hill that goes up from the driveway is south-facing. And then the general, there's two slopes to that land. So it goes east towards, like, large hills, but it's also facing, like, on a very slight hill south. Like, as you go down, like, below what's the patio now. So it looked like immediately we could see, like, how exposed it was to the south, the southern hemisphere, which is super important at this latitude.
Indeed.
That it was indeed, like, a really good option. Maybe it's not by the lake like Sunny Bray, you know, which is an amazing sort of mesoclimate as well. But, like, for us, we were really happy with that, you know.
And climate and micro or a meso climate, the local variation in the climate, especially around here where there's a lot of topographical variety, can make a huge difference. Go 300 meters one way or another way, and you're in almost, especially I'm sure for winemaking, quite a different, as they call it in French, the terroir.
Yeah.
The land plus, of course, there's the human community and all its culture around, which we've been talking about when you're in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
This was around 2012, 2013.
Yeah, 2012 was when we bought it, yeah.
And then, of course, there was the very mundane but really critically important task of assembling the vines that you're going to be growing, the varietals, deciding what ones would grow in this particular kind of climate.
Yeah.
And, of course, building and buying structures so that you could do the work of making wine. What was that process like? Instead of now studying it, instead of watching other people do it, instead of visiting other people's wineries, here you are, you're taking on square on the actual task.
Yeah, it was exciting but very stressful. Like I think the least stressful part was, the fun part was deciding what grapes to grow, because the research we used was encouraging. I think that's the first thing that we looked at, was what could we grow here based on, what we based it on was the Environment Canada statistics from the last, I think it went back to like 1981. There was a weather station. There were two weather stations for a long time in those decades.
In this area.
Yeah, there's always been the one by on the near town here. Mm. But there was one that was transmitting for a long time at the airport. Mm. And then for some reason, at some point, they stopped getting those.
I seem to remember Ernie Doe was involved in the recording of data, and I think as many things happen in a small community, if somebody's there willing to do it, it gets done.
Yeah.
If they're not there, it stops happening.
But it was great to have the two, because you could see two different the airport was much, much, much colder than down by the town here.
Indeed.
But we calculated that basically where Marionette was, it would probably be up to 5 degrees warmer than downtown because of the cold air that comes off of Mount Ida. It makes a big difference. Where the town is, and if you look at the history of Salmon Arm, there used to be a lot of fruit trees sort of downtown, but at various points they got wiped out by severe frosts, severe winter weather events.
In the 1940s, the apple industry was destroyed, basically.
Yeah, and North Broadview fared a little bit better, but we're not actually on the North Broadview Ridge, which made we were hopeful that. Like, just the way Marionette is structured, that cold air, because it's a very steep hill, an immediate hill, that would draw the cold air off. I remember in university, for vineyard placement or vineyard establishment, the sort of axiom is neither at the top of the hill or the bottom of the hill. You know what I mean? And that's Marionette to a T, right? It's not at the top of North Broadview. And it's not in Canoe. So it's perfect location. And so all the cold air does sort of drain off it. But at any rate, we based our varieties on statistical data from the weather stations here and where that's been. There's loads of places where you can find scientific studies where they've basically said Pinot Noir needs this amount of growing degree days. Merlot needs this amount. You know what I mean? So we pieced it together from that and found that we were very similar to Burgundy and Austria. So that's where we went for varieties. Yeah.
And you have five of them.
Yeah.
Some of them are, the names are well known, meaning that I even know them. Pinot Noir and Pinot Blanc and Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
But there's two Austrian varietals. Now, you hadn't, that wasn't one of the places that you went and sort of enmeshed yourself in the wine process. What was it that, was it just that they grew in this kind of Miso environment?
There's some other varieties that I would love to... Like, one of the ones I loved when I was in Europe was a Hungarian wine called... it's called Bull's Blood in Hungarian, which seems like that sort of... like almost Dracula sort of,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
Like...
we couldn't find people, so we used bulls.
Yeah, Transylvanian. There are, like, if you go into Central Europe, they've got very, very old wine industries as well. Mm. And they've got varieties that have acclimated to their growing regions, the same as Burgundy, the same as Bordeaux. But we chose the Austrian varieties because of a near hit that we had when just before we had kids. We were set to go work in Austria in this really amazing winery in this village. I can't remember where it was in Austria, but he only grew Zweigelt, which is what we make the Pulcinella out of. And it was this amazing winery, and he was going to welcome us both as winemakers to come work with him. And he had this like tiny winery where he bought like barrels off other people and flipped the one end off and used them as micro fermenters. So he'd have like hundreds of them. So like your day, and all he made was Zweigelt. So like he would just come and like manage each like tiny fermentation all in a row. And I really felt like I had to see that, you know, and we never did. But it did pique our interest. Like we were very close to London. So we would head up to London on the train and do all these like we did these trade tastings where like literally almost every year Austrian wine like winery would come to like the to do this massive like for the wine market. Basically, like you'd get like famous wine writers like Jancis Robinson, Oz Clark, who are some of the most famous BBC sort of, you know, like Hugh Johnson, wine writers, and their people were there, and so we were there, and then we got to taste all these wines, and we really developed a love of Zweigelt and Grüner Veltliner, which means, I think, the green one from Veltland.
yes, I think it does.
So it's a green wine. Yeah, anyway, it is
actually green in color.
Yeah, it is. Like it's quite a beautiful clear wine. Yeah.
Let me ask you a question, because we're sort of veering towards the end of the show. With a multiplicity of varietals. Mm-hmm. Obviously each varietal has got some somewhat different properties. Was there any consideration of what's going on right now around us in terms of climate? There's mm-hmm. some mm-hmm. major shifts taking place. Of course, there's not much you can do about extreme weather events, but in terms of the climate changing and the trends that are happening, did that enter into your decision-making with respect to the varietals you chose? Obviously, if you have more varieties, you know, one might do better, so you have a little bit of an insurance, if you like, a bit of hedging.
Well, I think for that, we chose to look at it scientifically. So, like, we basically looked at the last... Like, when you look at climate, you have to really look at the last 40 years, you know? And, like, weather events might seem incredibly extreme and harsh, but they don't... They, in our way of thinking, shouldn't be the decision. That you can't know what's going to happen. And if, like, I don't know, like, if you look at what's happening now, like, fire... More fire, extreme fire events, more extreme winter, like cold events, does not mean that you can grow, right? Like, it's not like we can grow Merlot. It doesn't mean that because things are... I like the fact that they don't talk about global warming so much anymore, which is, it may be true that the temperature is rising, but it's better to look at climate change as climate change. You know what I mean? Like,
indeed.
So we looked at it scientifically in terms of what... Like, the varieties we choose have to be happy in the range as if we were still in, like, 1984, you know what
sure.
I mean? And this region could have produced Pinot Noir way back then. It's not like, you know, it would have been harder. There were more events where, well, I don't know, like, this year we had minus 27 in December. We had minus 27 last year, and that's just the same thing as, like, 1986, 19...
And your vines...
Yeah, they're fine. Yeah,
they,
I mean,
they rested.
They took some hits, but they still produced grapes last year. Yeah. You know,
how about the heat dome, which is fairly unusual?
Yeah, that was probably more disruptive than any. It had a knock on effect, which is pretty poorly understood. But there's a lot of, you know, that's a very big stress event for sure. That's a worrying.
Well, there are a lot of worries. I think any time you're relying on Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. And her abundance to develop something that you're selling into the market. I have a feeling we may need to have you back on the show to talk about the intricacies of actually growing wine
and the
business and how you distribute it.
We didn't get to that.
We didn't, but it's there.
Yeah.
The number of places you distribute to is astonishing, and that in itself is a measure not just of success, but of the fact that there's an interest in sort of wines that are created in special circumstances for a particular kind of area of the world, as you found when you're traveling around. I want to thank you very much, Jamie, for being on the show, for sharing not just your love of wine, but your love of the world of creativity.
Thank you very much for having me.
No, it's been a great pleasure, and I look forward to having you back again.
Thank you.